Welcome, everyone. This has been a little bit impromptu. I just called a bunch of guys because we had a lot to talk about. So sorry you've had no notice for this at all. I am sure that you guys can forgive us because the news was so exciting we didn't want to faff about. Yes, I literally puked when I heard this, genuinely. I should be in hospital on a drip right now. But it's so important to bring you this really big news from the UK that I've called in reinforcements and we're going to talk about it right now. So we have with us our Nemo the Mormon.
Hey, hey, hey.
Sarah, do you want to say hey?
Hi, everyone.
And we have our Peter Bleatley from Mormon Civil War. You want to say hey?
Hello. We all need catchphrases, don't we, for moments like this?
We need a thing. Okay, so we're going to just jump straight in. So the news that was announced yesterday, I'm going to just summarise is this. Yesterday, there was an announcement from the UK government that mandatory reporting laws will soon come into effect. Under new rules, anyone working with children and young people in regulated sectors could be barred from working with children ever again if they fail to report a disclosure. It also means that anyone who actively blocks someone from reporting or covers up a disclosure of child sexual abuse could go to prison for 7 years. Mm. Now, it is our hope that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints globally, as well as in the UK, will welcome yesterday's announcement. And it's our hope that they're already considering how members of the church, especially here in the UK, who will become mandatory reporters, are going to receive training to be able to understand their new responsibilities and that they can feel confident in being able to do that. Sarah, do you want to just bring us up to speed with what does this mean? Is this the law at the moment? What does it look like?
No, this has come out of a recommendation that was made in the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. We've talked about that inquiry several times. It was published last year. There were 15 inquiries that looked at high profile sexual abuse cases and situations across the UK. One of those specific inquiries focused on sexual abuse within religious settings. As part of the inquiry, over 7,000 victims were interviewed. Many, many churches in the UK provided statements, including our church issued a statement about abuse, which we have talked about previously on podcasts. And out of that inquiry, one of the recommendations was made that everybody working in regulated activities, and a regulated activity is defined as three or more contacts with children in a 30-day period, or any one single contact with children between the hours of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. in the morning. So quite a wide definition, certainly brings into play our youth, our primary, across the board, Sunday school, camp, activities across the board for our under 18s at church. So, and anybody who's delivering those services, a volunteer or paid worker, is eligible for an enhanced DBS check with the check of the barred list, which we have seen in the UK. The church are doing that. It's in play. It's happening. So what we know at the moment is it looks highly likely that this law is going to bring the church and all faith communities under the same remit to report abuse. What we know at the moment is the law is being introduced as part of the Criminal Justice Bill that's currently just had its second reading in the House of Commons, and the government are now going to be making amendments to that bill prior to third reading and going to House of Lords so that they can put in the amendments that they want, the wording they want. And that's what we need to wait to see. We need to see what is the specific wording going to be. Are there going to be any exemptions? Is there going to be any strong lobbying of government for organisations that might want an exemption to mandatory reporting? If so, really interesting debate comes up then, doesn't it, about kind of why are we not welcoming these laws? What are the issues? But really interested to see. So for now, what we can do is we can discuss the potential implications. We can discuss the benefits. We can discuss what's needed, what's necessary. And then we will be able to revisit this as we see the final crafting of the law, and we have the exact specification and definitions in front of us. But as you said, it will become an offence under that law to fail to report recognisable signs of child sexual abuse. And let's put a pin in that one and come back to it. It's an offence to try to block anybody from reporting sexual abuse, and it's an offence to be made aware of abuse, whether that is by a victim or a perpetrator, to not report abuse. So we need a huge pin in that one around if a perpetrator discloses they've abused a child, that has to, under this law, that will have to be reported.
It will now have to be.
Quite a few pins we need to come back to.
I'm going to come to Peter in a second to give us some global Mormon context around this, but I also just wanted to let our audience know just about the fact that Sarah has been working in this area for such a long time, and your background in social work and in policy making and working with people who are affected by many of these issues. Since we have started as 21st Century Saints, and more broadly as we're hanging out with the Brit Avengers, since we started working, and really Sarah has been the driving force behind the safeguarding campaign that we have done, Sarah, we have delivered a lot of training and talks to different organisations throughout the United Kingdom, from organisations who want to better understand what's happening and how they can help. And, you know, based on that, Sarah has been invited to, train people sort of more formally, and has come out of retirement to engage in a really exciting role there. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for everything that you've been doing, Sarah, because this really does, you have helped so many people understand what's happening in the church, and also to be able to shape those changes. So we're going to come back to some of those pins in a minute, but Peter, could you bring what's happening just now into sort of global Mormon context? What's actually happening with mandatory reporting?
Sure. The church's headquarters are in the United States of America, and of course what's normal there tends to just be cloned and become the general policy globally without too much local variation. Within the United States, I think it's about half or more states, it's kind of 50-50. Some states have laws that make certain people mandatory reporters, which means they must report their knowledge of any abuse going on to the authorities, to the police or child protection services, while a lot of others actually protect what they call clergy client, clergy penitent confidentiality, that if, for example, a person confesses to a religious leader that they are abusing a child, those clergy people do not have to report it to the police. And that's particularly based around that being a very strong doctrinal tenet of the Roman Catholic Church that's kind of established that in that situation. It's not necessarily a Protestant habit. And there are lots of conflicts around this. They're particularly trying to weigh up whether having that opportunity for people to disclose they are abusers in confidence actually leads to more of them getting help or being persuaded to stop or change their ways by the clergy, which depends entirely on those clergy being trained to even handle that situation. Or is it actually far better to prioritize victims in all situations over perpetrators? It's very messy ethically. People have huge arguments over it. But the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints position has been to actually support the Catholic Church and others wherever possible in fighting any and lobbying against laws that would increase the mandatory reporting, and to use that as a reason to effectively suppress reporting of child abuse that occurs, particularly by clergy in the church. And there are many situations where that is now hitting the headlines and being huge scandals, and lots of scrutiny now of the church's whole system and the advice that its helpline lawyers give to local clergy. And this has become a sort of real focal point now, because just recently a state president called Rhett Hinsey, who's 53, my age, in Pennsylvania, is now being prosecuted because he failed in the year 2000 to disclose to the police, to the authorities, that one of his bishops that he was the supervisor of was abusing children, was abusing, I think it was his nephews. And it may well be that he was advised not to disclose that by the church's helpline, but he was actually breaking the laws there, and he's in big trouble. And this, in a way, should perhaps ring a lot of alarm bells, and certainly is there, that LDS stake presidencies and bishoprics who are aware of abuse cases and haven't been reporting them, that they could be vulnerable to prosecution, certainly there. So
Did you just nearly see persecution?
Idea, yeah. I nearly did. It's the slip of the tongue. My conditioning kicked in.
Right, yeah.
Completely justified prosecution.
Well, because, yeah. And the reason, I'm joking yeah. about it, but it becomes, the church often argues that under the banner of religious freedom, that we should be allowed to have particular exemptions. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it goes to court to argue those cases wherever it can, even though there are a lot of church members who are very uncomfortable with that and want legislation. And even in Utah, the Mormon heartland, it does come up regularly. People keep trying to introduce mandatory reporting legislation, but the church authorities oppose it, so it never gets through because there's quite a strong conflation of church and state in that area. Mm. So it's Nebo. A very live issue.
Quite a good example.
I'll come back to you in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Quite a good example of the church fighting for any exemption it can get under the basis of it being a religion is where the church took the tax deductibility of temples all the way to the European Court of Human Rights, pleading religious persecution and violation of its religious rights to have a 100% tax deduction on a building that's only open to its members and therefore isn't a public charitable good. So, I mean, I've covered that, so we won't get too into that, but, you know, it is the nature of the church to fight to get its way whenever it can. And I think what we're seeing here, particularly, if you don't mind me bringing this to the Bisbee case for a moment, is that what happened in the Bisbee, Arizona case, which is that case where Bishop Herod had Paul Adams coming in and confessing that he was abusing his child, and you know, that bishop didn't report it under advice, and the next bishop didn't report it under advice. And the rulings now are quite interesting because there are exemptions to mandatory reporting in Arizona. And what they are around is whether it is reasonable and necessary within the concepts of the religion to keep that confidentiality. And this is where the church declared itself pleased with the decision granting summary judgment that the church didn't break the law. So the church has declared itself pleased that the ruling found in their favor, that they didn't have to report, that they were able to successfully use that exemption because it is an opt-in exemption there. So when the church has an option between mandatory reporting and an opt-in exemption, they are pleased when they are legally allowed to use the opt-in exemption. That's a matter of legal precedent now for the church.
If I can just translate that a little bit, what the opt-in thing means is the church is under no obligation to tell its clergy to claim confidentiality and exemption. They're under no legal obligation to not report abuse. They can absolutely choose to do it, and they can tell their clergy that they must always do this.
Yep. But the reason they didn't, if I can just round that point off real quick, is that the court's decision said, plaintiffs are correct that it would not have been illegal under Arizona law for Herod, the bishop, to report the abuse, but it would have violated church doctrine. So we can put a pin in this and come back to it. But somewhere in the ether, unbeknownst to many of us, there is a doctrine of the church that prevented that bishop from reporting the abuse. I want to know what that doctrine is. And if that doctrine is indeed a doctrine of the church, then that would be the basis on which the church here, if they were seeking an exemption to this mandatory reporting, surely would seek it. They would say, well, hang on, there's a doctrine of our church. And they would have to cite it and say, this doctrine precludes our clergy from reporting. So we want an exemption based on that. So we can put a pin, come back to that, but I think it's an important
thing
to
raise. That's really helpful. Yes, thank you. I'm going to come to you in a second, Sarah, but let me tell you what what happens when you guys start, you know, citing American precedent. It's really difficult. You have to, because this is, you know, a church which is has most of its sort of center of operations in America, mostly one state in America, and that's where everything's happening. And it's so the precedents are all being set from there. But what I think happens with most people here in the UK that I've sort of interacted with on a warden stake level, thank you, bringing it back to the United Kingdom, is that it seems to be, we kind of tend to perceive it as, look, that's happening over there. This is just a really weird thing that happens in America and we're not comfortable with it, but it wouldn't happen here. And what I think Sarah and I, and, you know, speaking for Ruth as well, what we are able to make very clear is those types of cases that you have just used as illustrations, we have had conversations with people in the United Kingdom who have experienced similar situations in recent and historic. We have spoken with people and their families who this is a current lived experience. So I want to make really sure that people aren't getting the impression that, you know, this is something that's happening far, far away land. This is happening here and this is an issue. Now, Sarah, I'm going to come to you in a second, but when we're talking about these issues about what's happening with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints seeking for any kind of exemption or privilege or whatever that might look like, when this initial inquiry was happening, when the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse was happening, the church was asked to contribute and make a statement. And in that statement, you'll recall this a bit more clearly, I'm sure, because you just lapped this stuff up. The church made it clear it didn't want the law to change. It didn't want this to happen. What was it? Can you sort of familiarise us a little bit with what the church contributed to that inquiry?
Well, the church spoke about the church spoke about DBS checks, background checks, and they said they were aware of them. They knew they could get them if they wanted them. They knew how to use them. There have been some occasions when they had obtained DBS checks, so they were fully aware of this. However, they weren't really looking at doing it. They seemed to think that their system of sustaining people in public within church and putting people's names to the congregation and the congregation raising their hands and saying, yes, I sustain that person for this calling, was in itself a safeguarding measure. Because if people knew any reason why they shouldn't be working with children or youth, they take that opportunity to say.
But so, then did anyone here prove that those votes don't really mean anything? Did any of us?
No. Well, absolutely. I mean, that there's all that. And there's so much attached to that, isn't there? There's so much attached to it. So there was a concern that they weren't really, DBS was there, but they weren't really at that time taking it seriously, that this was something they could have in their toolbox as a really useful tool in their safeguard of children and vulnerable adults. They also spoke in the inquiry about policies and procedures. Other people were making the point about how important it was transparency and oversight, and people were looking at procedures and policies of faith communities. And they said, well, they didn't have any external review of their policies and procedures, but the First Presidency monitored them all. But the First Presidency are all in Utah. They're all elderly white men, and they're really not au fait with what's happening on the streets of Birmingham or somewhere like that for safeguarding, are they, within the church community? So it's a bit hard to see how that was really going to be helpful.
Yeah. And I think ultimately when
we should point out that So that was the situation a few years ago, and it appears that this legislation is a response to that whole inquiry, and that was our church's contribution to that. So since then, you know, there has been significant progress that with some, you know, grassroots pressure, including from certainly a lot from 21st Century Saints, that a national policy was enacted for the United Kingdom and I believe the Republic of Ireland as well. By the Europe Area Presidency, that they would make it church policy that anyone working with young people would have the police background check now. And over the last year or so, that has started to be rolled out, that specialists, yeah, safeguarding specialists have been appointed in every stake. The systems for DBS checking are being used, and that is a growing thing now. We're getting that embedded, and training is starting to happen. For
yeah, and we're going to talk levels. About that. Absolutely. Before we close yeah. out. We have a lot of news about that. So yeah. yeah. But I think what I'm sort of trying to put across, I guess, is that when people, organisations, were asked to sort of, what are your opinions? What's needed? Is government oversight needed? The church was quite clear, or the person who provided evidence yeah. for the church was quite clear. The church don't want to be compelled through law to do anything, that, you know, that if there's, you know, that churches should be able to operate in that way. Now, this is
they wanted to operate on a voluntary basis.
Yes.
They wanted to do everything they did on a voluntary basis. The problem is they weren't doing it on a voluntary basis, but they wanted to be allowed to, but they weren't doing it.
Does right. not like to be compelled.
Right, exactly. And so I wonder if somehow that's the doctrine, the elusive doctrine that we're talking about. It would be interesting to find out.
If the government compels us, then we shall press against the doctrine government compulsion.
Yeah, we shall not be compelled in anything. Anyway, with the inquiry, what we saw was the most important recommendation that came out as a result of the inquiry was that victims and contributors wanted mandatory reporting laws. So this is what's being asked for. Now, that could have happened quite quickly. And up until, you know, I think even just as early as 7 weeks ago, we had, people who had contributed to the inquiry who are saying, we feel like we haven't been heard because we've gone through all this and nothing's actually happened. Now we have this. The government spent a lot of time listening, taking some feedback about what this could look like. All of this is going to feed into what the ultimate laws are going to look like. So those are still being shaped right now. But it's really interesting to see that in the space of this year, on the back of that inquiry, that actually lots have been done. Now, the church hadn't been compelled to do DBS checks, but they did decide to do it. And there was clearly, because we experienced it, a will to do it. Maybe not universally, but the vast majority of church leaders and members wanted this to be brought in. And we'll come back to how that looks at the end. Sarah, can you say some more about what you're hoping for? What are you hoping this will look like in the church?
Yeah, I think first of all, let's just make a comment so that we can acknowledge this and make sure we're fully aware of it. Mandatory reporting is not universally welcomed by everybody working in a safeguarding space. Some people worry that it will prevent children coming forward and talking about abuse because they're worried that they can't have a conversation unless somebody's going to go and report it, and that may put some children off. So there is some concerns around that. And the other concern that comes from religious communities is that if people come forward, people will not come forward to repent and confess that they've behaved in an abusive way to a child or anyone else because they won't seek help. But my argument to that is, can the church point to one single case of anyone who has confessed that they've been abusing somebody or have abused when they've had a fantastic outcome and they've proved that the victims had the help and care they needed, there's been justice, there's been accountability, right. There's been evidential change of a person's behaviour, effective risk management. And I don't think that unless there's been intervention from professionals, somebody going and confessing that to a priesthood leader within the church will have ever led to those outcomes. And I think we also need to be really clear that anywhere, if there's any exemptions anywhere across the board about people not reporting concerns around abuse, they should be left with people that are very specialist in the field and know exactly what they're looking for and how to handle it, not a group of volunteers that don't know very much about safeguarding. They are not the people that are in a position to make a decision about whether something should be reported or not. So if people are in that position, you need mandatory reporting to keep everyone safe.
Nemo, you were going to make a comment?
I was, and then
well,
Sarah,
you're on the spot now.
So
come up with something fast, pal.
Yeah, no. What I was going to say is I guess there's arguments to be made around how if you know that if you do something wrong, it's going to be reported, then does that make you less likely to do something wrong in the first place? That's possibly a sort of alternate argument to that also. But I think the point I want to make really is about how this puts yet more pressure on the volunteer individuals.
Yeah.
And so I would like to very much explore how, so we know that there's a helpline in the US that goes straight to McConkie, but we also know there's a helpline in the UK that goes to someone that for some reason we're not using the name of tonight. So he who shall not be named mans a church helpline. And I think it should be very clear. This is what I think, and I could be wrong. I think that helpline under this new law will have to tell people, right, well, then you need to report this bishop. You need to report this state president. That seems like that's where this law is heading if everything goes as we're expecting it to. That should be knowable, not just to the person manning the helpline. That should be knowable to the bishops, to the primary presidents, to everyone who's working with these children. They should know what advice they're going to get anyway. And that helpline should just be there to reinforce if someone's not quite sure for any reason. What this does essentially then is takes away that helpline's power to tell anyone to do anything other than that, I would imagine. And I think that needs to be really, really clear, because then if that helpline is seen to act in any other way, were it to, then it's very clear that it, you know.
Peter, I'm coming to you in a second. Yeah,
Sarah's going to tell me off, but then, yeah.
No, I'm absolutely not going to tell you off. I think what you said then was fabulous, Nemo. I love it. I think what the church needs to seriously do now is sit down and look at the role of the helpline and the stage at which the helpline becomes involved. Because if this law is passed, if this is signed into law across the UK, that abuse has to be reported, and you can't tell anyone not to report abuse, and you can't cover it up, and you can't pretend you don't know, and you can't leave it with the family or the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. You have to take responsibility to report it. Then actually that should be done before anybody speaks to the helpline, because in speaking to the helpline, they're building in delay. And the purpose of this law is to prevent delay and get help where it's needed as soon as possible. So I
could
think
the helpline... Could the helpline operate then, say the helpline weren't to be manned by a lawyer, but say a professional in safeguarding, say the church changed the operation of the helpline, would that be useful if it were accessible to everyone, as Ruth is making points in the comments? So they could call up and go, I've seen this has happened. I want to be certain that this is a sign of abuse, because I'm not quite sure, because these people are volunteers. So anyone can call this helpline
Absolutely.
And go, this is going on. This is the situation I found myself in. Does this sound like abuse to you? And they'll go yes or no. And then if that's manned by proper professionals with professional ethics, who aren't worried about the church's best interests, but just about the best interests of children, then that would be a really good resource for people.
Because I know from
my experience as a medical professional, one of the really helpful things is to be able to go to a colleague or a senior manager and say, this has just walked into my clinic room. I'm thinking this. What do you think? Because it is difficult to make that call on your own, particularly when I was quite new as well. It's difficult to make that call on your own, as I'm seeing something. Is that, you know, people say, oh, you'll know abuse. Positive, possibly. But Jane, I see you've got maybe some pushback on that.
I'm going to see Sarah. If I could get you just to hang on to your response, because Peter, you are currently a mandatory reporter and you have a lot to say about this. Now, I have loved in the Brit Avengers in total, when we think about all of us, I mean, we've got like five of us at one point, I think, were mandatory reporters for different reasons out with the church. And I mean, some of the discussions you guys were having, there was really robust debates about things, all of it extremely positive. Talk to me about what should happen. So as a mandatory reporter then, I mean, because it sounds like if I'm calling up the helpline to find out if I should be investigating or asking more questions, I'm not sure if that's what is the right way forward. Is that really mandatory reporting? Is my job to investigate or ask questions? No. Tell me what happens with you when a disclosure happens.
Yeah. So I do think people should be able to have people that they consult to get advice and guidance. And those people should know exactly what they're talking about. So as a high school teacher, as a secondary school teacher, we get annual training. We are very clear within our school organization about who are the four or five people in the senior leadership who we must report any concerns about abuse to and consult. And it is then their job to get in touch with legal authorities and to take things further. But there are loads of safeguards around this. So those people will have a lot of training at quite a high level, as well as the training we get about how to handle an abuse disclosure, what abuse looks like, what the categories are, and how what to actually say to someone disclosing abuse, what you can or cannot promise. For example, you can't promise confidentiality. Mm-hmm. And there are further safeguards, if we are not happy that our concerns were actioned sufficiently by those senior managers, we have a right to go back to them or to other authorities whose contact details were given to raise that concern and to ensure that something didn't get swept under the carpet and has been properly dealt with. So it's not, you don't just hand it over to them, and whether they deal with it or not, there's nothing you can do. You are very much empowered that you can still have kind of aftercare to that situation and ensure that things are not being ignored. And these are just some of the many safeguards built into that kind of a system, which we've never had in the church before, but are starting to come in. Because of these, you know, quite unique kind of niche we've carved out for ourselves here in the UK. There are some countries like Australia which require mandatory reporting and all these systems as standard, and the church is very happy to cooperate with those and act out those systems. But wherever they can resist it, they seem to. Now, the church policies and culture, and by culture, I mean it's enforced by their handbook and guidance and what they actually do, has been very clear to bishops that as much as possible, they do not want them personally reporting anything to the police, and they definitely don't want them appearing in court as witnesses. And that whole culture of trying to shift responsibility away from their own clergy as rapidly as possible, that where as much as possible, they should plead with families to report themselves if there is an abuse situation, rather than have the church clergy person do it, and that if the family doesn't report, they will as often as not, if they can get away with it legally, tell the clergy person not to report it and to wait until the family decides to, and to very much not just flatly refuse to appear in court cases. And there have been several cases in the States recently that fell apart of really bad abuse, where you have this, not irony, I don't know what the right word for it, hypocrisy, tragedy, where the church knows that someone has abused their children or harmed children, done its own disciplinary procedure of holding a trial and excommunicating that person for that abuse, yet at the same time, that could never go to a legal trial with the legal secular authorities, because those same bishops who made those judgments and were being witnesses in those courts and giving witness statements within the church's own systems were being told by the church's lawyers to flatly refuse to do the same in an actual court of law. And that's why we have this concern about where the church's leaders' heart is going to be with whether they resist these efforts to make everyone mandatory reporters in Britain, or whether they will go with it and have a healthy system. So that's my experience as a teacher. It's very different to the church culture.
Right. And I want to push back at, you know, what you're saying about, you know, people being discouraged from testifying and, you know, things like that, or discouraged from reporting, or where excommunication takes place instead of, you know, actually legal proceedings. But I can't push back against that, because I know that happens. What I'd like to do, just Sarah, could I come
can,
to
can
you?
Can I just
for
say
second?
Though, in the church? Oh, yes, sorry just I should say, yeah, sorry, just in the church's defense, though, and this is part of these contradictions we're always trying to navigate. The church also has language in the handbook very, very positive about needing to report immediately and make sure that happens. But when you look at the small print, it's nearly all about making sure anyone other than the church's own clergy are doing it, because the church is clearly terrified of being in any way legally implicated as being responsible. And it will go to extraordinary lengths to avoid that, to the point of covering up abuse in effect and enabling perpetrators to carry on being a problem, even though they've excommunicated them and in a sense within their own, they've protected themselves, but they haven't protected wider society from these dangerous people. So there's a lot here that and I think part of the reason there is this complacency and overconfidence by the church leadership is they are used to functioning in a sort of legal political situation within Utah, the state of Utah, which is predominantly Mormon. There's very high Mormon populations in Idaho and Arizona and other places, where they have strong political sway, where it's usually clear that nothing will pass in the legislature for the laws of Utah if the church doesn't give permission, as in the church general authorities, the top leaders. And so I think this has made them just complacent, that they're so used to getting their way and not actually having to experience the usual systems of accountability and scrutiny that we would find as normal in pretty much any other part of the world, from the law and from journalists. That they have not been aware of the danger they've exposed themselves to, and that they have put their own clergy in, who are volunteers. And what is happening now in all these cases in the States is the chickens are coming home to roost. Now that people are finding out about these systems, they are challenging them in the courts. The church is paying out fortunes to do non-disclosure agreements or to settle out of court in case after case that's holding the church itself responsible. And this is just escalating, and there are going to be some pretty epic class action lawsuits around the scouting program and other things.
Can I just say, I'm very glad that it's not my job to stop Peter talking tonight. It's Jane's job. Because he's making some very good points and the people will be mad at me if we stop him. But I get the sense that some other things want to jump in.
That's right. Go for it.
I should be in hospital right now. I'm feeling actually quite, despite this being an extremely sensitive subject, I'm feeling a little bit soothed, I'll be honest. You need to record me some stories, Peter. I'll come to everybody in a wee second, because I want to hear any... Sorry, Sarah, on you go.
I was going to make some comments.
Right, I'm going to come round to everybody in just a second, okay? In just a second, because we're going to wrap up the mandatory reporting conversation so that we can blow the lid on DBS checks, and that's going to go a little bit quicker than this. But what I would say is, because I'm going to come to Sarah, then Nemo, then Peter, just to close up mandatory reporting. Sarah has said very, very often, for those of you in America who are saying you guys don't have this and we wish it would come to our country, no one can tell you not to report. If you decide morally that you are going to be a mandatory reporter, that if anyone discloses abuse to you, that you will acknowledge and act accordingly, no one can tell you not to do that. Right, Sarah, tell me what you're thinking, because I know you've got a lot to say.
Right, quite a few things I'm thinking based on what Peter was saying. First of all, isn't it interesting that the church even has a risk management team and department? Why does a church that should be concerned with our eternal salvation and saving ordinances and redemption and everything around the love of that, why does that organisation need a risk management department and team? So that's very interesting that they have that to deal with abuse. So it's rather difficult to say there's not an abuse problem when they've got a whole risk management team dealing with it. The other thing is,
there was lawyers who offer the deals to pay lots of money to keep it out of court.
Absolutely.
To be clear, what she's referring to. Yeah,
absolutely. The other thing that's really clear is that the church issued a statement, didn't they, not so very long ago, making it very clear that nobody in the church should be going to make statements to the police, giving evidence in court or doing anything like that without speaking to the lawyers of the church. Well, you know, I'm sorry, this has nothing to do with the lawyers of the church.
Unless the church is going to offer you free legal counsel and they're offering up their lawyers to help represent you, that's the case. And they're like, don't do anything until we've had a chance to make sure you're properly lawyered up for yourself. Great.
Well, interestingly, they're not. Because
that's not.
what they told that bishop in the case in Arizona who failed to report abuse, so the abuse continued for 7 years and involved another child in the family, what they said to that bishop was, you can't report this abuse because you might be sued if you do. Well, that is where the church should have put their money where their mouth is, and they should have said, we have such a strong moral compass about protecting children and safeguarding the most vulnerable in our community. You report that abuse, and if the perpetrator is foolish enough to sue you for reporting abuse, we will defend you in court. We will pay all of the costs. And if there is a compensation award, we will pay that as well. Because do what is right and let the consequence follow. Now, that's it.
Because they declared themselves, they declared themselves pleased with the outcome that they'd been seen not to break the law in their actions.
Right.
So they're clearly willing to put a legal team behind defending themselves when it comes to, oh, did we break the law or not? So they could have done exactly the same, but for the bishop. Yeah. Quite right, Sarah.
Absolutely. The other thing is, and I will literally say no more than a sentence for this, or Jane will mute me for the rest of the evening. We have become aware through the work that we have done with victims, 131 people over the last 12 months, we have become aware of victims that have told us that bishops were willing to make a statement about abuse that they had seen or a perpetrator confessed to. They were willing to make a statement, but as soon as they spoke to the church helpline, they were told not to get involved and not to make a statement.
That's why we're not naming who operates the church helpline.
We have spoken to victims who have confirmed that to us, have told us that. But I say no more on that because I don't want to go anywhere near doxing any victims that have shared that with us.
We're not doxing the lawyers. Like we've spoken, their names have been mentioned
many times. They're big brave men. They're big brave men.
I just don't care enough, really.
No. The other thing I wanted to make the point about, and it's kind of fitting with the conversation we were having a little bit ago about mandatory reporting and speaking out and talking about abuse. Peter was talking about having discussions, understanding what's going on. Is we can have all the legal changes and all the laws brought into this country that we want around safeguarding. We can have a church that say we will uphold those laws. We will encourage our members to follow those laws about mandatory reporting. But if we still have an environment where people are scared to speak out, where people feel they dare not criticise leaders, where people feel the power dynamics are such that they cannot be honest and the culture is such that they have to kind of be well behaved and not rock the boat and not talk about abuse. It doesn't matter what the law says. Until we get cultural changes that are across the board within the church around dynamics and equality and people prepared to speak out and supported genuinely to do so, it's going to be a difficult game. And I have to say that my experience has been talking with loads and loads of bishops and leaders and people, as Jane has done, as we've all done. Most people really want to see mandatory reporting. Most want to report abuse. They want to protect. They want to safeguard. They're good men for the vast majority. They're good men that want to safeguard and care and protect. But then you get an organisation that is so obsessed with reputation and finance that it gets its risk management team and its lawyers involved.
But isn't it ironic?
Jesus had trouble with lawyers, didn't he, as well?
Isn't it ironic that in the church so desperately trying to save its reputation, what they're actually doing is sending out to the world
destroying a reputation for being
a place where people can come and get easy access to victims. Absolutely. And the church will do anything they can to protect itself from any ramifications, which leaves the perpetrator free to just crack on for 7 more years. That's the reputation they're actually portraying
and
to the world.
That's right. That's right.
And if they
want
to fix that, they need to take this seriously. Sorry, carry on, Sarah.
They really do. I think that was the point I wanted, but I could go on forever and ever. But
yeah. Go on there, Jane.
Yeah, and we have more episodes to do in the future about it. So, yeah, we'll be talking more about mandatory reporting, and we will be going on to the big news about DBS. We're going to spill the tea about how it's really going. But before we do that, mandatory reporting, anything else you want to talk about, Nemo? Anything else you want to share?
I can't think of anything. If there's anything you've got in your mind that I've mentioned before that I failed to mention, then please remind me of it. Because we were chatting before we went live. But nothing really. Sarah, you've had a thought, so please.
Yeah, but, and I want to go back to what you mentioned earlier, Nemo, because I just don't think we can, I don't think we can overemphasize it. What is the doctrine that tells this church they do not need to report abuse? What is that doctrine?
And that
please
may
tell
have come
me
up in
please
America.
Please tell me.
But the doctrine of the church, as we know, it's well established, it is worldwide. The doctrine of the church affects members wherever they live, in whatever country. We've had talks about how the doctrine of the church and the culture of the church is the only real culture, and if you try and keep your native one, then you better leave that alone. That was a particularly lovely talk at conference. But like, these doctrines are universally applicable. So if there is a doctrine that is being cited by a judge, he's had sight of it, or he's been told by church, this is the problem in America, and it's a problem that then spills over to the wider church. A judge gets told by the lawyers of a religion, we have a doctrine that says we don't have to do this. He does not feel he has the right to go, show me the doctrine, tell me what the doctrine is, show it to me. Because they'll go, ah, no, First Amendment. And then they'll go, we don't have to tell you our beliefs. We don't have to justify our beliefs to you. So they'll just, so the judge won't even go near it. So they get to allude and say, oh, well, you know, it's a doctrine of our church that the bishops keep this confidential. Where? Show me the doctrine. You don't have to prove it to the judges, but you certainly have to prove it to me as a member. I want to know what this doctrine is that means if I report abuse to my bishop, for some reason, he can't tell anyone about it.
Yeah.
What is
100%.
That?
100%. Well, is this a little bit akin to the family proclamation, where it was written as an amicus brief in the courts in Hawaii, so the church didn't have to go with, they could argue against gay marriage?
Well, maybe they'll actually produce something.
Is this akin to that? And now a lot of people seem to think that that's doctrine and canon scripture and all the rest of it, but actually isn't.
Well, Dan, but is this way it would be.
Yeah. Well, he said it was founded. He said it was founded on
doctrinal the moment
truth.
He's prophet,
he didn't say it was a doctrinal truth.
The moment he's president. Well, anyway, but yes,
okay,
I get
Nemo,
your
stop
point,
upsetting
Sarah.
Me. Stop upsetting me. We need to focus
on
this.
Look at where you started. Okay. Peter, soothe us with that relaxing final thoughts on mandatory reporting. Go.
Yeah, so I think what we're dealing with here then is it was so good for Sarah to bring up the culture, you know, because that does dominate. People just need much more education, much better training. It's very difficult when you have a purely amateur clergy with a very high rotation, loads of people with access to young people, loads of people in different roles of authority. None of them get professional level training in anything of any kind. Certainly not the kind of clergy training that a Church of England minister would have to go through for years in counselling skills, in appropriate legal boundaries, in psychology, in adolescent psychology, all the rest of it, and child psychology. We have none of that. We have the idea of discernments that God's Spirit will miraculously help these people to always do the right thing, but that's obviously been proved to be completely dysfunctional in rather a lot of situations. So I think it's going to mean a huge culture shift, as you've alluded to, that we'll have to very much change how we function, how we train people around this, what advice we give. I think there needs to be support and legal advice to members of the church getting into this if they are functioning in a priesthood role. I think that's absolutely appropriate. And what Nemo described is what we thought the helpline was about. We thought the helpline was about providing sensible legal advice, protection, financial support, whatever it would take to enable a volunteer clergy person, a bishopric member or state presidency member in the church to be confident in reporting abuse.
Moral outcome.
Yes, and to protect themselves, you know. But what it turns out to be is the bottom line over and over again, at any cost, at the cost of hundreds of victims continuing to experience abuse, if necessary, has been to not cost the church money, full stop. That's been the bottom line. It's about protecting the reputation or the finances of the church from prosecution, or being held responsible and accountable. I would just say my final thoughts sort of on this whole thing is sometimes the church can get, and church members can get, this sort of delusional sense of how they're the only people who can help anyone, that they're the only functional organization in the society of their members. And they think that if anyone compromises the ability of bishops to confidentially receive confessions, no one else is ever going to hear about abuse, which is nonsense. Usually abuse is reported to people you trust within your family, or you've got all kinds of opportunities at school for young people with professionally trained people to look out for signs of abuse and to be reported to and to handle that professionally. There are loads of charities offering services. There's free helplines like Childline that people can call to get advice, to disclose, to get support. So I think it's just really important for church members and leaders to be reminded you are not the be-all and end-all. You aren't the only people that can ever help these people. You think you totally rule these families' lives, but we all live in a larger world. We're at school, we're in society, we're online, we can phone someone and children can work that out. So don't, in a sense, give yourself the pressure and stress that if you're not somehow providing all the options for abuse to be dealt with, no one else is doing it. Trust these organizations. They're far more trained than you will ever be.
Can I make a really quick 30-second point?
Nemo, go.
Really quick. Yep. Mm-hmm. So when I was wandering around as a young man in the chapels of the church, and this may still be true now, I knew exactly who the church and its buildings were insured by. The church's buildings are insured by Zurich. You know how I know that? Because there's a little piece of paper on the notice board that says, you know, the church is up to date with its liability insurances and whatever its building insurance, etc. You know what I didn't know? I didn't know who I should talk to in a case of abuse. I didn't know who the safeguarding officer was. I didn't know any of those things because the church has shown, that is a microcosm of the church's attitude. It is very concerned with who insures it and not as concerned about making sure its members are insured, as it were. But please move on to DBS checks.
So I'm going to have to do this super quick because we're going to have to wrap up in a moment or two. But if I was a church leader who has been part of the process of implementing DBS checks, if you're doing anything with safeguarding just now in the UK, you may have heard this news and thought, oh, what now? It may have just been the worst possible news because you have so much on your plate already. Believe me, I understand. Question one I want to ask, Sarah, with regards to where we're at with now mandatory reporting, it would be quite easy for the church to try not to do it, to try to claim that they're not a regulated activity and walk back the process of DBS checks. Tell me if that's likely, and if not, why not? And we're going to just do this super quick.
Yeah, I wondered about this. Would the church wish that they no longer delivered regulated activities? They can only walk away from saying they don't do regulated activities if they stop holding primary each week, they stop holding youth each week, they stop having youth camp, they stop having conventions. One hour church. It's coming. The day is coming. But they would have to walk away from the youth and primary programme as we know it now to stop regulated activities. I can't see the church doing that until such times as they absolutely have to do it because there are no youth or children left. And I can't see that happening until then. But that's the only way they could walk away from regulated activities is to stop delivering them.
Absolutely.
So the cat's out the bag on that one.
And so, well, exactly. And especially as since DBS checks, criminal background checks were introduced and the church has formalised what that's going to look like, then, you know, we are now here.
Shout out for Doug.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much, Doug. We love you.
Love you, Doug.
You're our angel. So why would church members be, or church leaders, people involved in safeguarding, be dreading this, do we think? Sarah, is there sort of universal positivity about how the process of DBS checks are going? Are they all done? Are we all DBS checked?
We're certainly not there. No, we're not there yet at all. But I think from what I've seen...
But the deadline, though, was the end of the year. So right, what's happening?
Well, the deadline was the 31st of December. And in accordance with policy, anybody who did not have a completed DBS by the 31st of December should have been released on the 1st of January. Now, we have written to the church lawyers and we have asked them to explain to us what is happening in this transitional period. How has the church put forward a rational, defensible decision that people are still in callings without DBS, bearing in mind it's a transitional period? And I have to say, it's not surprising the church needed a transitional period. They were taking on a mammoth task, and I can quite see why they have needed a bit longer to transition fully to DBS. But I think what the church needs to be doing is being very, very clear about the date this will be done and when releases will start if this isn't done. I think the time has come for them to be very clear about that now. And also for them to share what their defensible decision is. We did give them some ideas about what they could say, but I'm quite sure they've been working on it for months and have got it all sewn up.
Yes. So if they have a clear policy statement, it's going to be very helpful for them.
I think it would be really useful. Absolutely. Because Neville, the first thing... One thing that I have reminded bishops about frequently is if there is an allegation of abuse and anybody is in a calling without a DBS check in contravention to the church's own policies, the church is immediately in an extremely vulnerable position. The bishop is as well, but the church is as well, extremely vulnerable. So I have pointed that out many times. So
didn't the church make it clear in the excerpt into the independent inquiry that the bishop is the one that is called
safeguard? Absolutely.
So the bishops just start releasing people.
I just get a bit cross with, I don't think the church does anywhere near enough to support our bishops, but and that just makes me a bit cross.
But
universally, I have to say, what I have heard over and over again from members is, I don't know how it's taken the church so long to do this. We should have been doing these DBS checks years ago. And universally, that's the message that whenever I've spoken to anyone who's come back to me about this, everybody's like, I don't know how it took them so long to get here. And DBS checks are happening. They're going well. There's a universal commitment and will. People see the benefit. People want them. People are not kicking against them. The system's just ground a little bit more slowly than it should. But people are wanting it.
Yeah. I'm in a ward with a large percentage of Americans. And they are one of the biggest problems I think the church is facing at the moment, just in terms of the smoothness of the system. But I'm hoping that in resolving these issues, that will provide a model by which the church can background check people.
What the church should be doing, where they've got people, Americans, is they should be checking the sex offender register in America, because that's open for the public.
We all
to
know
check.
What American federal systems are like. They 100%. Are. They were designed on Windows 97. They've never moved on, and they, I'm surprised it's not a Rolodex in someone's cupboard.
Which is why the DBS, as we have consistently said, has to sit as part of a process. It's not about you've had your DBS check, you've had your criminal background check, and so therefore, I am very, very clear, I think, that what we've been able to see is church leaders who are feeling a bit disheartened, I think feeling really quite disheartened that this is not going as well as they had hoped. And I think I can say that quite confidently.
Overwhelmed.
And unfortunately, they're overwhelmed. The time scales aren't working out. And this is where I find myself in the unusual position of sort of trying to say, Sarah, too, that actually, please don't be disheartened, Latter-day Saint leaders. You're doing a fantastic job of trying to implement this. When an organization this size tries to do anything that's involving any kind of red tape and working with multi-agencies, it's not straightforward. And what you gave yourself was an extremely short time to have this completed. If it would have been introduced rapidly, then it wouldn't be robust. So you must give yourself this time to make sure that it's robust, to make sure that everyone understands what they're doing. And that's probably going to mean you're going to have to push the deadlines back a bit. Yes, you will have to start releasing advising people who are just not clicking the links on their emails. That happens.
Because it's a big red flag. If someone's refusing to have a background check, massive red flag. You probably don't want that person in that calling.
So, yes, you're right. But
if they're refusing, most aren't.
Avoiding, you're normally getting some kind of signs of avoidancy that are more than, you know, just not clicking the link. When we've all had, why haven't you confirmed your password links and been locked out? So people are just not very good at technology sometimes in the church. And if you recall back to when family history went digital, and you know, family history consultants were assigned to go into homes and
I tell you what, family history consultants worked with much more gusto than I've seen some people moving around the DBS issue, to be fair, because when it comes to saving dead people, the church will throw money and time and everything you can at it. When it comes to protecting children, they're a little bit more reluctant.
Pushing back a little bit, the church were in charge of their entire system. The church, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, GEDCOM is thanks to Mormon technology. Some of the files that so the church sort of evolved a lot of its own technology there, invested a lot in it. Here we've got a church organization that's trying to get British bureaucracy on one side through another agency on another side, and it's just the wheels.
You're being too kind today. DBS checks are quite simple, and if they hired enough people,
they are simple.
To run the system of taking people's details and running them into a DBS.
The biggest delay is not the church leadership, and it's not the church DBS team either. The office the church has set up, that is not where the delay is. They respond extremely quickly. And I have to say, believe me, I will criticise them when they're not doing it, but my experience is they are very quick off the mark. The delays that we're seeing in DBS is simply down to members not filling in the application. That's where the problem is. Now, that could be solved overnight. It's really
just
simple. All the bishops need to do, well, that would solve the problem. But the other thing, all they need to do is to just go knock on somebody's door and say, we need you to do DBS application. Or when people get to church on Sunday morning, instead of them going into the second hour lesson, sit down and do the DBS application there and then. That's what they need to do. The bishops need to gather every single person who hasn't done their DBS and sit them in a room and say, you're not going to Relief Society, Sunday School Youth. They're done away with this week. We're going to do your DBS
With the same vigour that they chase people up for tithing settlements. And I think you'd have it done overnight.
Like you say, the family history consultants knew how to chase people up and were empowered in doing it. I think some of those approaches are good. Now, that may be where DBS checks are. It's slower than the church would have liked. I don't want them to lose heart about it because is what we would expect. I am feeling very positive about it still. Now, what I do have concerns about is the training that safeguarding specialists and those who they should be interacting with. I would like to see that picking up a pace
because I think we look at Sarah and we go, it's excellent, but we forget that Sarah is a well-trained former professional who's essentially come out of retirement to do this. Other people are volunteers who are going to need bringing up to Sarah's level, and that's going to take time.
Peter, thoughts? What are you saying?
I'm with you. You know, I think it's our stake specialist is in our wards, and she's on it. You know, we had great training when all the adult members of the church and I think they had the teenagers in as well, I can't remember, but received the training that all the congregations have been given. Absolutely, there's total goodwill for this. I think particularly in the modern world, a very significant percentage of any average congregation are going to be people who are already DBS checked or have some kind of safeguarding training in their roles in work. So it's already, you know, they don't need convincing. It's already a given that this is the right thing to do. I look at it in two ways. There's always the local and then there's the global sort of politics within the church. So the local, these people are absolutely up for it. My stake through, not just through the stake president, but through several leaders in the stake, pioneered us introducing DBS checks independently of the church early on, and that helped it to then be an example to roll out across the country. So I already know that my area is a hotbed of people who are all over this and absolutely 100% behind it and doing it with the best will in the world and sincerely. But and I'm in also in a congregation where the serving bishop was imprisoned and convicted for child pornography offences. So we have experienced both ends of that spectrum, and these are all happening within the same congregation. Yeah. So, you know, safeguarding just has to be a thing. You don't know who the people are going to be. Everyone needs to be safer. If we really care about our children, this is an absolute given that our safeguarding should be watertight and platinum plated and the best in the world, in every part of the world, regardless of the laws. And that's where we come to the global issue, where we get completely contradictory messages from the First Presidency and Quorum of 12 Apostles and the handbooks they create and what they deploy their lawyers to do. That you have on the one hand complete positivity where it's legally required, on the other the most intransigent, unbelievable cruelty to child victims of abuse by going the extra mile in the courts, in calling the money grabbers, covering up people, calling victims of abuse seeking justice or accountability. And mainly all they want is for the people who are dangerous to be stopped, and the church is protecting them. And you've got the worst possible case of that. This destroyed the credibility of the Roman Catholic Church a long time ago. And the LDS Church learned nothing whatsoever from that, and in fact is still doubling down on the same things the Roman Catholics have now abandoned. For example, using non-disclosure agreements as their number one go-to response to an abuse case, which the Catholic Church, in its inquiry into its own dysfunctions, concluded was one of the tools of covering up abuse. Therefore, they stopped doing that. So we have so much to learn. The grassroots members are living in a sane, mostly secular, rational world where they genuinely prioritize children, and they can't imagine that their lovely, cuddly grandparents' First Presidency would ever think any differently to that. But the reality is these people in leadership are incredibly dangerous to all the children anywhere they can get away with perpetrating and protecting abusers. It's that extreme, that contrast. That's what this fight is going to be about still as a global organization and for the culture and heart and soul. And they just do both shamelessly. And it is disgusting. It's the reason huge numbers of people are leaving this church and taking their children away from it, because they simply know they're not safe for that and many other reasons. Your children are not safe in an LDS congregation where there isn't background checks on everyone and professional standard training, just as they wouldn't be safe in any other organization that doesn't have safeguarding systems and professional training. And when Sam Young, who you know, really campaigned for better safeguarding practices in the church years ago and got this ball rolling in the modern age, when he was asked by reporters, would you recommend that someone with children joins this church? They really put him on the spot. I can't remember what his answer was. It was probably, well, no, I really can't recommend it. And I'm sorry, we're all in that situation.
I cannot recommend
to my friends with children that they come to an LDS church until everyone is properly trained and these systems are in place. Brilliantly, wonderfully, through a conversion of emergence of the local priesthood leaders and women leaders and 21st century saints and people campaigning for this in lots of different areas, we have accomplished a unique situation here in the UK where, even though it wasn't legally required, the members here decided we can't take these risks anymore. We're going to make our congregations safe. And I just hope that all the congregations and stakes and wards across the country, across the world, across particularly in the American states where they have these legal thing shenanigans going on, that they just simply say to the church leadership, no, we're going to have background checks, and we're not allowing children into our building until it's safe for them. And it's simple as that. That's what it comes down to, is the safety of children.
Peter, thank you so much. Nemo, you are causing controversy in the chat. Okay, final thoughts for you on DBS. Nemo, anything you want to say?
Well, I you brought me on here to be cynical. I'm in a ward with a lot of Americans. And I know I'm impatient. I know you guys want to give grace to the church, but you know, I haven't had answers from my leaders around, you know, what doctrine is it that prevents people from reporting abuse. There's certain fundamental doctrinal questions here that I think need to be answered. I agree with Peter that's what's gonna push this on a global scale, because yes, what we achieved here in the UK is wonderful, and everyone here played a part in that to a smaller or a greater extent. And I think it's excellent, brilliant. And, you know, there are church lawyers that dislike me heartily, and yet they still did the right thing. But that's not enough for a faith that's expanding into countries like into places like Africa, into countries where you know, safeguarding is not as well known in day-to-day life. And they have an opportunity here to bring that into the developing world and into these places where safeguarding policies aren't as prevalent, and people will start to go to their church because they know that's a place where their children are safe. Because I agree with Peter, and I agree with what Peter said about Sam Young. If someone asked me, would you bring your children to this church, still I couldn't quite answer yes. Once I know that, because the thing is, they'll present someone for sustaining at the moment, and I don't know whether they've done their DBS check or not. I don't know. It's not become that formalized yet. It's not become that entrenched yet. And we need to give it time to get there. But particularly for me and other people that are in very American heavy wards, there's a sense of, oh, do we have to? Because it's just so much more complicated with the Americans at the moment. And the whole point about missionaries needs bringing up as well, that, you know, you've got these young lads who are coming in, and I know there's things in the White Handbook that try and safeguard them, you know, don't hold anyone's child, don't change nappies for people, don't babysit for people, all the sort of common sense stuff, which is good, but they do really need checking over before it's we bring them into our communities.
Comment on that in a moment. I love that you pointed out, Nemo, about the time factor, because as much as actually I do genuinely feel really positive about where the church is on its journey in the UK as it comes to DBS checks specifically, not so much about maybe some other things, but you know, the will is there, all of these things have to be celebrated. It's really important to recognise that for people who have experienced abuse within the church, or abuse, you know, outside of the church in any form, to say that these things take time doesn't help, and in fact can cause a lot more pain. And so I'm very conscious of the fact that this can also cause a lot of pain when we sort of are defending how long it's taking.
I know if I were a bishop, I'd be the first one to be saying, right, okay, we don't have primary at the moment. Oh, why don't we have primary? Because so it's like, it would almost be, it seems like unkind, but you know, we have this policy, we have a deadline. If you cared about those primary children that you're responsible for, you would have got this done. You, my primary president, you haven't done it. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to release you and find someone else. And there is going to come some social consequence with that. And that is what will begin to, unfortunately, it sounds harsh and cruel, but that is almost what will begin to entrench DBSs as a serious, real measure that we take, because people lose their callings over it. People will get released over it. And so that's how seriously we're taking it. And that will speed things up. Because if, and I believe Sarah, I'm not saying if as though I don't believe you, if what Sarah's saying is right, I have no reason to doubt it, that it is the members dragging their feet. That's release, the way to get them to stop dragging their feet. Just release them.
I agree.
And they're going to get released.
I think they
publicly.
Should.
Why have they been released? Oh, because they didn't do their DBS check.
I think they should release people. I really do think that time has come. They should start releasing people now.
Cool. Well, on that note,
Might be grateful to be released.
Yes. on that note, and I'm Sarah, we're going to have to be super brief here. Do you have any final closing thoughts on DBS checks that you want to share?
No, I think we've covered absolutely everything that I want to share. The point has been made about missionaries in the chat, and let me just say very clearly, we are well aware there's a significant problem with unchecked missionaries coming into this country. There's a problem with missionaries leaving to serve that are not background checked. We are in discussion with leading charities about this and about the impact and the role of government are going to have to play in this. We have taken this and spoken to the church about this, and we will continue to do so, because 21st Century Saints, along with our Brit Venture colleagues, are calling very strongly upon the church to ensure that every single missionary that comes into this country is subject to a background check, and that every single missionary leaving this country is subject to a background check. Not a ridiculous question being asked, have you ever abused anyone?
Before you give them Let's get them background checked.
100%. Absolutely. And so that is something that we are working on actively. So those of you who've raised it in the chat, Ruth, Doug, others, absolutely love your concern for this, and I promise you we're on it and we won't be letting go of it.
Yeah, and we will have lots to tell you about it.
We will.
Just 30 just
second point
shortly.
The church will make you remove your wisdom teeth so that they don't have to pay the insurance for you to have them removed while you're on a mission, but they will not currently make you have a background check before you serve abroad. The church cares more again about its healthcare liabilities than it does about protecting children in that case. So
that's abusive. That is abusive in itself.
Yeah.
Okay. So my son needs me, and I'm gonna go and hang out with him before I mosey on off. I need to tell you guys about a few things. So first of all, just to close out on the background checks and the DBS checks, we have a unique opportunity. This we talked about this after the ICSA report was published. There was a unique opportunity in the church for the church to take on board those recommendations and to do something. We suggested they do background checks and begin to really implement a programme of safeguarding here in the UK as a result of those recommendations, and the church listened and we were delighted. Now new guidance has come out around mandatory reporting and it's about to become law. And what we recommend, both morally and just because it makes absolute sense, that while the church is in this phase of rolling out DBS checks and basic safeguarding procedures, that you take this time now, instead of panicking about government interference in things like reporting and how you deal with pastoral issues. We want to stress, abuse is not an ecclesiastical issue. Abuse is a legal, moral, social issue. And as communities, we agree to look after our sick, our vulnerable, and those who need to be cared for as a result of victim experiences. If you take the opportunity to embrace looking at the organisation and seeing how we can better cater to the needs of those who are vulnerable, then you can be the world leader that you would like to be when it comes to safeguarding. And we are so far from being that now, but you have this unique opportunity here in the UK where everything's happening, where the stars are aligning to make this as easy for you as possible. So we invite everyone to step into it. Yes, a lot's happening. I know you all must be exhausted because I, you know, Sarah and I know the work that you're putting in here in the background. It will pay off, and so don't lose heart. And the world is watching to see how this goes on. There's a tendency, and especially with post-Mormon spaces, to look and kind of think the church is going to mess everything up like it always does, and doesn't really want to get it right anyway. Right, yeah. I mean, that's what everyone's kind of thinking. You don't have to fall on your ass with this one, okay? The steps are all very, very clear. And everyone is supporting this journey. Everyone wants it to succeed. Okay, before we go, I need to tell you, we are having a massive party in Scotland in a matter of a few weeks. In April, the weekend of the 13th, everyone's coming to Glasgow to hang out. All of these guys are going to be here. We are having Kaylee karaoke. I've dropped a link in the chat, which I'm going to do again. But Thrive Scotland has got some of the best activities you're going to see. Your ticket will pay for Saturday in the incredible venue, which is Oranmore. You will not believe how stunning this building is. It is historic. You're going to have a ball. Not only do we have some fantastic things lined up, such as how to swear like a Scot, the Sunday is completely free of charge. So come up, we're going to do things like fire spinning. We're going to do some food tasting. So you're going to get to taste the cuisines of Glasgow. Curry, pasta, fried Mars bars. Yeah. What else? What burger? Like everything, you know, that is from out with Glasgow. You come to Glasgow, we specialise in appropriating your cuisines and deep frying it. So we're going to have a ball. We've dropped the link there. You can get your tickets and come and hang out with us. What else? We are going to have a ton of fun. Sunstone early bird tickets for the UK will be going on sale just shortly too. We'll be giving you more information about that. But we want to see you in Thrive, because I haven't had a chance to hang out with you guys for such a long time. So please come and visit. Thank you so much to our guests tonight. I love you all, and I really appreciate the comments, the donors. And if you need to get in touch and reach out, if you've been affected by any of the issues we've discussed tonight, drop us a message and get in touch. We would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for your time tonight. Good night.
Good night. No.